Hi everyone, to the first talk in the Room Bull for this year's Tag der digitalen Freiheit, short TDF. And our first talk today will be from Ruben, from Cardus, who will talk, tell us about something about mastering disasters. So give us a warm applause for the first speaker of this TDF.
Thanks a lot. So when I asked whether I should talk in English or in German, I was asked to talk in English. We know that here im Ländle, unser ehemaliger Ministerpräsident hat ja damals schon gesagt, Englisch wird die Arbeitssprache. Und wir sind ja auch ein weltoffenes Ländle. Jetzt muss man der Landesregierung bloß noch erklären, dass das mit dem weltoffenen Ländle vor allem für die Leute gilt und nicht so sehr dafür, dass die unsere Daten dem Palantir da weltoffen in Rachen einschmeißet. Und, aber weil der Talk ja nachher auch im weltweiten Web drin ist, täte ich den Rest vom Talk Englisch schwätzen. So, thanks a lot for joining, everyone. I want to start with a trigger warning. This talk contains pictures of Friedrich Merz, Jens Spahn and other highly disturbing content. But I guess you are aware of that, as we are going to talk about disasters. And disaster can hit in quite different shapes, including cyclones, wildfires, and of course, old white males. My qualification to talk about disaster is my official academic title, a Master of Disaster degree, which I obtained at the university in Bonn, more about that later, and some practical experience I gathered co-founding Sea-Watch and other projects such as Kabul Luftbrücke, as well as working in different war zones, including Ukraine and Gaza. Furthermore, I'm holding several criminal complaints for insult by the Bundeskanzler with an ego even more fragile than the one of the mayor of Tübingen here. So in contradiction to what the last slide might have promised, I don't want to add to that. And in this talk, Merz will only state a kind of side note he should also become for federal politics. Nowadays, I'm working with the humanitarian organization Cardus from Berlin, an NGO that originated from techno and festival subculture. This origin thereby is directly linked to the subject of this talk. A main idea when Cardus was founded was that people who are able to drive a wheel loader and that are quite efficient in improvising and setting up infrastructure to run techno festivals for thousands of people might also be quite useful in the disaster response. During our classification as an emergency medical team with the WHO, one of the examiners called Cardus the humanitarian plague block, which of course only referred to the color of our mission clothing and not to any sort of radical beliefs as part of the corporate identity. At this stage, I also want to clearly point out that this talk reflects mainly my own personal views and is in no way approved, authorized, peer-reviewed or whatsoever by the organization and therefore my employer. The day rate for today's performance will, of course, be paid directly by the Antifa GmbH. Having that put straight, now I'm done with the disclaimers and we can start with the actual content of the talk. The SURF, in German, der Aufschlag, for this talk was given by the mayor of Berlin, Kai Wegner, in January, but more on that later. Let's start with a little reflection on the history of civil protection and disaster response in Germany. After the Second World War, the Cold War scenario was a driving force shaping the setup of civil protection and disaster response mechanisms. And it's a law of the nature, and we can experience that also today, that the resources available for disaster response and civil protection are directly proportional to the fear of a Russian invasion. To know this law of nature is quite useful if you want to do finance planning for humanitarian or disaster response organizations. Of course, this is highly simplified here. Because unfortunately, the calculation for a holistic approach for disaster risk management is far more complex, as there are also some other laws of nature, such as the negative correlation of resources for climate protection and adaptation with the number of conservative politicians in parliament. Master nix, as we say. But let's continue with the chronology. Back in the days of the Cold War and the constant threat of nuclear escalation, not only incredible amounts of resources were invested into the nuclear arms race, but also into civil protection. The idea of civil protection was integrated a lot into normal life. This tunnel, upon which I grew up in Reutlingen, in the house of my parents, is not only built for cars. This tunnel has quite massive gates that can be closed and is actually dual use. It also has quite some side rooms, emergency exits and entrances, and also some fancy equipment like camp beds, tin cans and so on. However, today, it's nothing more than an awesome adventure playground for children like me, as long as you own a square plate screwdriver. At some point in the 90s, the bomb shelter had stopped being maintained, because the year that I was born had changed everything for civil protection. The Cold War was over. In the East, the wall was taken down, and in the West, the resources for civil protection were cut. There was no fear of a Russian invasion anymore, capitalism had won, and there was no need for shelters any further. The doctrine was to believe in unhindered economic growth and the individual's chances and responsibilities. Natural disasters from now on would be defeated by the market. We felt safe. We could even have Dieter Bohlen perform in Moscow without Berlin getting nuked in response. And we would have enough blue-lighted cars to have two of them coming for one patient. That's the superiority, that's the prosperity. Maybe for those that are not so familiar with the German emergency medical system, here you have an ambulance that comes with a paramedic with limited authority and then the emergency doctor is coming with an extra vehicle. Not to all, but to quite some of the emergencies. This ensures high standard of treatment, but also is quite resource intensive and rather atypical compared with other countries. So it was a time to transform swords into plugshares, which also meant civil protection vehicles to camper vans. We believed in the exuberance of resources capitalism has brought to us and that problems were the problems of individuals that were solved on an individual level. The climate emergency wasn't a topic yet and the forces of nature felt manageable. Only very deep in Western Germany, very deep in a mountain on which sour wine is growing, you can still find some of the old glens. Some of the Cold War-style civil protection setup. In the museum of the old government bunker, the Regierungsbunker, you can still find everything ready for Armageddon. And there is a word you can read quite everywhere in the exhibition. It's Deutsche Wertarbeit, translated something like German high-class craftsmanship. What you do not read that much about, however, is that that tunnel, later used as the government bunker, originally also had another dual use, as the tunnel on which I grew up. But in this case, not for cars. An abandoned construction site for a planned railway tunnel was widened by forced workers when the Nazis, for some reason, needed to move their military production into a bomb shelter. But because inside the mountain, none of the sour wine is growing, the attentive employees of the museum have put a big green palm right in front of the memorial plaque for the forced laborers, just in order to make sure it's not too obvious and the Germans can watch their Deutsche Wertarbeit without being re-traumatized and bothered with their own history. So woke, so considerate. Well, Master Nix, we say. And anyhow, I also wanted to come to a bit more contemporary events concerning civil protection and disaster response. Only about 2.5 kilometers from the Regierungsbunker, there's another quite famous memorial of failed disaster response. Here, you can see the conservative, back then minister president of North Rhine-Westphalia, Armin Laschet, loving as he figured out where the site of the disaster is, shown on the map on the last slide, and that it's in the neighboring federal state, governed by the Social Democrat, and not in his own area of responsibility. He still made it to the news with his own business. Here, you can see the collapsed bridge over the River Ahr in Ahrweiler, which is located roughly the 2.5 kilometers from the Regierungsbunker, where I marked it in the map a few slides ago. I won't go into detail too much about the floods in Ahrweiler, as probably most of you have these events quite present. Here, you can see myself visiting the collapsed bridge, smiling as I figured out that another quite important site for civil protection that I know quite well is also quite next door in the vicinity. Only roughly 1.5 kilometers from the collapsed bridge, there is an academy for disaster responders. Actually, the academy for disaster response. The place where I also was listening to a lot of lectures during my studies to obtain the Master of Disaster degree. It's the Federal Academy for Civil Protection and Civil Defense. It's even ESO certified, so must be something really good. At this academy, there are many training courses for disaster responders and people in the administration on how to run a crisis unit. I also did one of these trainings there 1 year before the actual real flood as part of my studies. Ironically, the simulation was about a flood in the Ahr Valley, and already then our response was quite a failure. We had to write a homework about it to analyze the outcome that in a similar shape became reality a year later, which I am going to summarize with a few slides. Here, some pictures of such training, which I cut it out of the Academy's image video. They call it Stabsübung, as the crisis unit is called Stab in German language. This is funny because Stab also translates to stick, and the structure sometimes feels similarly stiff. What do I mean by that? Here, you can see how the disaster response is structured in Germany, like literally on basically any level. Here, for example, you can see it on the Bundesebene, the federal level. The source of this is the GMLZ, the Gemeinsame Melde- und Lagezentrum von Bund und Ländern, which translates to basically something like the Situation Room on a federal level, and it looks exactly as the old Egyptians defined it. And on state level, here for Berlin, where I'm living, literally the very same structure, the very same picture. But what is so wrong now about a structure that has proven itself since thousands of years on different levels? Well, one problem with pyramidal hierarchies is the trickle-down effect. While for financial wealth, it has been proven that the trickle-down effect just absolutely does not work, but for bad decisions, it certainly does. And the saying is, of course, the fish always rots from the head down. But next to the trickle-down effect of bad decisions, there is also a second major problem with pyramidal hierarchies, which is the bottleneck, pictured here. So, where's the crisis unit now? Exactly, there. But enough of boring and dry organizational theory. Now let's surf the action and look into some fieldwork. In early January, a blackout following a fire in a cable funnel left large parts of Berlin without electricity, which for many households also meant without heating. Until today, it's not really clear who sabotaged the cable funnel, but it is widely believed that a group that called themselves Volcano Group might be behind the attack. And as they are believed to be left radicals, needless to say, but thankfully, the member of parliament representing my district in Berlin, Ferhat Kocsek of the party The Left, nailed it in parliament and made it absolutely clear that this is in no way progressive to attack public infrastructure. And so did a confession letter that claimed to be written by the original Volcano Group that distanced themselves from the confession letter of another Volcano Group that was circulated before. But the chaos around the confession and non-confession should not be the topic here. I want to talk about the even bigger chaos around the disaster response and the lack of efficient coordination that we experienced during the days of the blackout. I remember well driving back to Berlin from south of Berlin that evening when the blackout happened. It was snowing heavily and I saw dozens of close calls and near accidents, as obviously also the traffic lights were not working. So of course, at the CADUS office and makerspace, we were also aware of the freezing, elderly or ill people Ferhat would later refer to in Parliament. For us, the task sounded quite clear and easy, as the area of operation was damn close to our storage. We are used to far more complex logistics. Normally, we have to get stuff to places like Ukraine, Gaza or Sudan. In this case, it would be less than 10 kilometers. The only thing we needed, we thought, were the keys to the storage and the keys for the transporter. So we wrote an email to the responsible structures within the administration and offered our support. Tents, heaters, generators, mobile lighting, everything we had on stock that could be useful in a blackout scenario. And then we waited. And waited. At some point, we got a response that our email would be forwarded. And then we waited again and waited. So what was the holdup? Well, for the mayor, we know that he was playing tennis. Fair enough, but doesn't he have support by a full-blown crisis unit trained in the Ahrtal Academy? Well, you remember the second problem of pyramidal hierarchies. I know from a source familiar with the matter that the crisis unit was so much bottlenecked that they weren't even able to answer support offers by other districts in Berlin. This also fits well with the picture provided by a friend of mine who is a volunteer firefighter in one of the affected districts. We were called to the station where we would have had everything, cars, generators, all of that, but there were no orders. So I went home again and told them that they should call me if there actually is a job to do, she told me. As the bottleneck issue on the level of the crisis unit was quite expectable and obvious, we decided to approach the next level below that. In Berlin, that's a concept called Katastrophenschutzleuchtturm, which means disaster response lighthouse. In the concept, it is written that those are places where people can get information and support. So I took a car and drove to the area of operation. I remember I learned something about sandwich feedback. So let's start with something positive, something that worked well. The lighthouse, well, actually not a house, but a car. However, this place was enlightened and well visible. Didn't need too much light, though, as everything else was dark, but still, they had a proper light bar. The Katastrophenschutzleuchtturm was a shining spot of hope for me in the actual and administrative chaos I was trying to navigate. So I grabbed that glimpse of hope that I would find the promised up-to-date information there. How up-to-date and information in a rapidly developing situation such as a blackout in a metropolis can be if you print them on paper, however, might be questionable. I mean, I'm really not a fan of Amazon, and preparedness could have saved it all, but even if they would have ordered a flat screen, only the first day after the blackout already had happened, at the point of time when I was trying to get up-to-date information from these clammy wet pages held by a few magnetos, they could already have had a nice 1 meter flat screen on scene. And a massive light bar is the proof that this car had electricity on hand. But I wanted to stay positive. At least I got some information there. Basically the very same unspecific information I already read on the website before, but well, if I would have been a citizen in that Kiez stuck without information, it might have been useful. Fun fact, guess how many languages the disaster responders of a European capital provided. You're absolutely damn right. Of course, the information was only available in German. In Germany, we can expect that German language is spoken, says Jens Spahn. In the desperate search for something that is working, to finish off my sandwich critique with something positive, I made all the way to one of the emergency shelters in one of the districts that had not lost electric power, where I would be able to charge my phone, as it said on the wet paper at the lighthouse. This is what I found there. Like, seriously? One multiple plug? I went in, claimed to be a geography student that does research for my bachelor's thesis, and asked them how things went. Overall, the mood of the personnel there was quite good and supportive. However, what they said is that they would have really wished for some chargers so people could have actually charged their phones, as there were people walking to that place for several kilometers just to then still be unable to charge their phone. But I did not only want to rant about classical disaster response. I promised also to talk about what we can learn from social movements for the disaster response. So while I was there with a friend, watching this lonely assumed €3.45 multiple plug from IKEA, we remembered the camps of climate activists we've been on together. Groups like Ende Gelände are actually working on providing power to the people, both politically and electrically. Even if you would come to a climate activist camp totally unprepared, you would find a charger and a power bank. But how comes that the hippies are more resilient and better organized than professional disaster responders. Therefore, we have to have a look at the structures behind such campaign actions. And be sure I will stay on kind of a more broad level. I know no names, no structures. But clearly a shout out to Ende Gelände at this point. By the way, the next action of Ende Gelände is end of this month. Ende Gelände, that are those activists with the white suits that are always appearing in at least the hundreds. To then stop the diggers in the open pit coal mines while police is trying to hinder them from doing so. It might sound easy, but I can tell you this is a really complex task. Probably it's at least as complex as to respond to a blackout in two districts with the resources of the whole metropolis on hand. So how does it work? The key to success here is to understand that the philosophy of how efficient coordination works completely differs from the pyramidal one we have just discussed. And as we know from starlings and other birds, as well as from my beloved children book Swimmy, swarms are sometimes the more efficient way to organize. There is a funny story from one of the big protests against nuclear waste transport to the Wendland. Back in the days, during a big sit-in with hundreds of people that was totally peaceful, a special police unit went in to grab the spokesperson of the initiative and some others, as they hoped the whole thing would then collapse if they take out the leader of the group. But nothing happened, and the blockade kept being organized. At a Castor transport, or equivalent, at a climate activist camp, no one would have to wait for orders, like my friend at the voluntary firefighters during the blackout in Berlin. At a climate activist camp, people find together in small groups and just start to solve the problems that occur. This does not mean that everything is improvised. You'll also find an information desk and a camp orga, which could be compared to a crisis unit in a classical disaster response structure. However, the philosophy behind the decision-making is different. The crisis unit rather shares information than orders and leaves room for creative solutions instead of micromanagement. Here, for example, there was a complex problem. Several hundred activists were stuck in a police cordon, but as it was down in the pit of the mine, they did not have reception of mobile phones. While police officers were preventing other activists and at first also parliamentarians from going down there to assess the situation. So a solution needed to be found, and it was. As you probably all know, sometimes the best system is a sound system. And as Emma Goldman said, it's not my disaster response if I can't dance. In 2017, CADUS deployed the first mobile hospital to Iraq and Syria. We were running a trauma stabilization point, which is a makeshift field hospital right behind the front line against the IS, with basically a bunch of activists. Surgeons, paramedics, nurses, but all from a similar political background. There, we spent several nights talking about how we could make use of the learnings we made in different forms of activism about resilience in chaotic situations. A lot of tools were discussed, developed, and adapted. For example, we adapted the briefing tool BeCorrect I once learned with an environmental action group. The BeCorrect is a form of acronym to realize efficient, participative action briefings instead of the classical endless plenaries we all knew and learned to fear. Next to efficient briefings, or actually to enable them, another key to efficient coordination in any kind of disaster response setting, no matter if in a pyramidal structure or in a system following the principle of mutual aid, is situational awareness, ideally shared situational awareness. This is also where, and that might be important for quite some here, safe-to-use software can become a real game-changer. The first idea for a collaborative geo-information system for the use in our missions came up in Mosul as well, as there were different grassroots groups and NGOs on the ground, and having a tool to share mission-critical geo-information would have been really useful and safety-relevant. In Gaza, the benefit of such software could have became even more obvious. If I wouldn't have seen it with my own eyes on my own phone, I wouldn't have believed it. The most efficient tool used by United Nations to share life-critical data such as evacuation zones would be to send a KML file into a WhatsApp group. To then hope that the, let's say, 70-year-old British surgeon spending his retirement in Gaza, in a Gazan hospital, is able to import to his Osmand or whatever software he's using in between the treatment of two patients. That was when we started the development of COGIS. COGIS, or also Collaborative GIFs, is an, of course, open source geoinformation system that comes with a robust environment and that, by following an offline-first approach, is optimized for low or no internet environment if someone has bombed away the internet or if Elon Musk is just switching it off. So a main feature of COGIS is that it allows user groups. So, for example, if the headquarter pushes a new KML file, it will just sync with everyone in the respective user group as soon as the device is connected to the internet. Thereby, it can be ensured that the surgeon I just talked about can concentrate on his job instead of the transformation of KML and KMZ files and so on. Of course, mission data can be super sensitive. So the security aspect was another important focus during the development of COGIS. I'm not doing the software development, but I can only imagine how tricky it is. Luckily, and thanks to open source and GitHub, we did not need to start from scratch. The basis for COGIS is OneFleet, a GIS tool developed by Sea-Watch and the Civil Maritime Rescue Coordination Center for the use in maritime SAR. And as this is a high criminalization context, obviously IT security was the main focus during the development of the tool. Another key question when setting up COGIS was the question of data sovereignty. Data security can only be provided if the ownership of the data is defined. So, similar, for example, to Mastodon, COGIS offers to host own instances. So, if you want to keep your most critical, most sensitive data for yourself, you can do so by just setting your own instance, while you can still share certain layers with other instances and user groups. This bears a great potential to crowdsource operational data and thereby to be a game changer for better situational awareness and therefore a better disaster response. While supporting the development of COGIS, I always asked myself, why isn't this tool already on the market? But I think it's exactly because here the different philosophies of leadership and coordination clash. It's exactly that meme. When working with actors used to pyramidal hierarchies, I often experience a huge fear to lose control and to give tasks or information out of hand. And there are valid arguments. There is a point in saying that one also needs to be able to trust the operational data mapped in a software like COGIS. And it is true. Maybe, for example, a carpenter shouldn't be the one collecting the medical data, and for sure not a Russian bot. However, if those people that fear fake news and the loss of control so much would stop scrolling on Instagram and even worse on X, they might realize that there are examples out there that approve the concept of community-based information gathering and peer review, and that this information might even be wider and more substantial than if you only have controlled but limited professional resources. Lefty groups such as Deutsche Wohnen und Co. and Eignen or the Left Party already realized that GIS-supported community organization is a highly efficient way to get things done and to widely roll out concepts. I experienced this kind of activism when a comrade one day rang at the door of my shared flat. She was organizing the plot to file a case against our landlord. But when a couple of weeks later the heating system in the block wasn't working, the chat group enabled mutual aid on a neighborhood level so that official disaster response could focus on the bigger picture instead of sending firefighters for micromanagement. The most important learning I wanted to emphasize with this talk is that to allow a certain level of controlled loss of control on the micro level, for example by providing a software to coordinate peer support within neighborhoods while collecting situational information for shared situational awareness, can actually help to enable efficient management and to maintain control on a macro level. If this would have been understood in the described Berlin blackout scenario, it would have been a game changer. And that's why we started the project Volunteer Map. And since this screenshot is only a mock-up, we still need your support for the development. The idea is to combine the Engel system, which is called Elfen system for shift management, developed and used by people around the CCC, and if I'm not mistaken, also used today at this event, with our COGIS system. Both of them open source and on GitHub, so shouldn't be that hard. We see a massive potential in this, as we think that sooner or later, this new philosophy of how to coordinate disaster response will also find its ways into official structures. And it already does. One good example for that is how the mayor of New York City, Soran Mambani, handled a blizzard in January. Pretty much same time as the blackout in Berlin, but totally different approach. Mamdani, instead of only counting on the existing pyramid, just increased the wages of the workers involved in the snow clearance and basically called everyone in to grab a shovel wherever they are and to solve the problem they'll find where they are on the spot. In no time, traffic was moving again in New York City. So, choose your tools and choose your fighter. To pull up this joke actually was my main motivation when I set the topic for this talk. That means I am more or less done with my talk, but still I have to close that sandwich on the disaster response during the Berlin blackout. And I found a way to do so. A big, big shout out to some refugees from Ukraine that during the blackout, unlike us at Cardus, did not wait for a mail to be answered, but just went and set up a point of invisibility, as they are called, and as they are routinely set up in Ukraine by ordinary people in the event of a blackout. These points of invisibility are a concept developed in Ukraine that is basically pretty much the same thing as the Berlin disaster response lighthouses, with the slight difference that the Ukrainian refugee actually brought chargers and USB cable. So the sandwich is closed, and so is my talk. Thanks a lot for the attention, and come to join us. If you have any questions, I think we have a couple of minutes left, and I will also stay around for a bit.
So, thank you, Ruben. Thank you, Ruben, for your talk. You already got your applause, but now we have time for questions. I will give this microphone around, so everyone who has a question, raise their hand, please. If there are questions, please raise your hand. Another microphone is in the back and will be going through. But I don't see any questions. Oh, okay, this microphone works and is a little bit loud. So, are there any questions? Okay, as Ruben already said, you will be around, so if you have any questions later on, find Ruben, you saw him here, so I think this was an invitation to talk with him. And again...
And also, if you are a software developer and if you are interested in helping us to support developing the volunteer map, then also please approach me.
This is an open invitation. Please go to Ruben later on. And again, give him a huge round of applause.